This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqara, recited by Ali Pariskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing.
As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news. Headlines: the U.S. Secretary of State says Washington will oppose the release of Iran's frozen assets in South Korea until it returns to full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal. The U.S. Congress finally passes President Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion economic relief package on a party-line vote. Also coming up, the U.N. Security Council condemns the Myanmar's military's use of excessive force against anti-coup demonstrators. Good to have you with us. Our top story: the U.S. Secretary of State says Washington will oppose the release of billions of dollars in Iranian funds from South Korea until Tehran returns to full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal. Antony Blinken said if Iran comes back into compliance with its obligations under the agreement, the U.S. would do the same. He added that the ball is in Iran's court. South Korea said last month that it had agreed on a way to release Iran's frozen money, but was awaiting the approval of the U.S. Tehran suspended some of its commitments under the nuclear deal after the U.S. withdrew from it in 2018 and reimposed anti-Iran sanctions. Iranian officials have time and again said Washington should lift the restrictions first. Iran's president has slammed the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal, meanwhile, for failing to comply with their obligations under the accord. Hassan Rouhani made the remark in a phone call with British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Rouhani also touched upon the impacts of US sanctions amid the coronavirus pandemic. He said the sanctions have doubled the problems of coronavirus patients in Iran. He added that the US has not taken any practical measures to revive the nuclear pact. The Iranian president described Washington as the biggest violator of the agreement. The British Premier, for his part, said his country, along with the remaining signatories, want to preserve the deal. Political commentator David Yehoubian says the European signatories to the JCPOA remain unable to make decisions independent of the United States.
I think he and the rest of the EU, and particularly if we're talking about the E3 in general, they stand on the fence once again. They are completely unable to engage in independent decision-making, either regarding their own interests or serving the interests of international law and the multilateral institutions that they are members to. And so they continue to just sit on the fence. I believe it's still beneficial that they at least give lip service to the idea of preserving the JCPOA, but beyond that, once again, they're just waiting. Now they're waiting for the Biden administration to make up its mind regarding whether or not it wants to continue with the illegal imperialist policies of the Trump administration, or if it wants to take a new tack, return to the JCPOA, start to heed international law and its treaty obligations.
Meanwhile, a former Iranian ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency has dismissed as meaningless the so-called step-for-step approach to revive the 2015 nuclear deal.
What does a step-by-step means? Because the sanctions are one, and you cannot find equivalent element in our obligations. What do they want? The whole sanction should be removed, and then Iran, as our officials have clearly mentioned and informed, then Iran goes back to where we were. Of course, we have taken steps, gradual steps, after 1 year of strategic patience from according to Article 26. Then Iran goes back. It is very difficult to understand, comprehend what does a step-by-step means.
Sultan here further said that the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden is continuing the policies of his predecessor against Iran. He added that the U.S. is making a serious miscalculation if it intends to use the maximum pressure campaign as leverage against Iran. He said Washington's return to the deal does not require negotiations, and the U.S. and the EU should not waste time with such propositions. Sultania, however, stressed that Iran is in no haste for the U.S. to rejoin the deal and has not rolled out a red carpet for it either.
Iran and the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden remain in a standoff over the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. The U.S. says Iran must take the first step and return to full compliance with the deal. But Tehran says Washington must do so because former President Donald Trump unilaterally walked away from the accord in May 2018 and reimposed sanctions.
Since the U.S. backed out of the deal, it should take the first step. The one that broke the deal must return to it sooner and knows that Iran is ready to fulfill its commitments.
Iran, which began scaling down its JCPOA commitments 1 year after Washington's withdrawal, says its measures are in line with two paragraphs of the accord and in response to the failure of the remaining signatories to fulfill their obligations. On Wednesday, top Iranian security sources ruled out a step-by-step return to the deal, reiterating that Tehran will hold talks with the U.S. only if it lifts its unilateral sanctions. Speaking to Press TV, they also stressed that Iran will fully resume its JCPOA obligations only after the U.S. removes its sanctions. Such a stance was the theme of the remarks made by Iran's leader during a speech last month. Ayatollah Khamenei also said during his February speech that Iran will never bow down to U.S. pressure over its nuclear program and could enrich uranium up to 60% purity if the country needed it. He, however, reiterated that the Islamic Republic will never seek nukes. Now, as Iranian officials say the ball is in the U.S. court on whether it wants to continue the so-called maximum pressure campaign launched by the former administration or reverse the course. This also, as Secretary of State Antony Blinken has already described the Trump-era anti-Iran campaign as a failed policy.
The Democratic-held U.S. House of Representatives has approved President Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID-19 stimulus package. Under the new relief plan, one of the largest in U.S. history, most Americans will receive direct payments of up to $1,400. The package also extends unemployment benefits, aid to local governments, and funding for vaccine distribution. The relief package received zero support from Republican lawmakers who argue the measure is too costly and wasteful. The passed bill is now awaiting Biden's signature to be enacted. Colin Campbell is our correspondent in Washington, D.C. and joins us now. Actually, we haven't got Colin. We'll try and get him as soon as possible for more reaction on that story. Let's turn elsewhere. The UN Security Council has slammed Myanmar's military crackdown on peaceful anti-coup protesters. The council's 15 member states said they strongly condemned the use of violence against the protesters, including women and children. The council also called on the military to exercise utmost restraint and emphasized that it is following the situation closely. Meanwhile, several anti-coup protesters were injured in fresh clashes with security forces in the city of Yangon. The Southeast Asian nation has been in turmoil since the military overthrew the government of Aung San Suu Kyi on February the 1st. The military complained of fraud in the November 2020 election. So the Democratic-held U.S. House of Representatives has approved President Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID-19 stimulus package, despite receiving zero support from Republican lawmakers. Let's bring in Colin Campbell, our correspondent in Washington, D.C. Colin, welcome. So is this being seen as a first legislative victory for President Biden, despite the fact that you've got a deeply divided Congress and zero support from Republicans?
Yeah, this is still looked at as a major legislative win for the Biden administration, even bringing in progressive support. And what the Biden administration tried to do here was form a coalition between some of the desires and the wants coming from the more progressive wing of the party and, of course, Democrats, also appeasing some Republicans. But like you said, it was fruitless. One of the things that some Democrats are a little bit unnerved about is the fact that the cost or the payout of the stimulus checks, which are now at $1,400 for those in certain tax brackets, they wanted those payouts to be a bit higher before. Well, the Biden administration lowered the offer to $1,400, down from about $2,000 for the stimulus checks, to appease Republicans who said that those payout checks were too high. Well, now that they've lowered the checks, they still didn't get Republican support. So you have Democrats who are a little bit upset at the fact that there was some type of acquiescence on behalf of congressional Democrats to appease Republicans who didn't support them in the end anyway. Regardless, there is still some amenability coming from the progressive wing, and this will be looked upon as something that the Biden administration and the president himself will have to go around the country and market a little bit, because it is $1.9 trillion. It's a lot of money, and Republicans are going to be trying to push that narrative of too much money is being spent on things that have nothing to do with COVID. The talking line right now is that only 9% of this bill actually corresponds to COVID. And of course, this happens many times when the bill is cobbled together trying to appease various lawmakers and getting some deals for the constituents they represent. So you have a lot of pork in this COVID relief bill. All the same, the president will try to show that it was very important to pass the bill. Republicans, however, are going to go on the fight to say that this was overspending, and they'll use this as a talking point for the midterm elections coming up in a couple years.
Finally, Colin, very quickly, are the measures that will be taken under this bill be enough for Americans who are living under the biggest, the U.S. being the biggest, having the biggest death toll and infections worldwide in terms of coronavirus, COVID-19?
No, there still will be a lot of Americans struggling. Of course, this is better than nothing, but that bar is pretty low when you start at nothing, right? There will be a lot of Americans who will still struggle after the money is spent, and they'll be looking for more aid, and the economy still isn't back up and running the way it used to. So we'll be hearing the woes of Americans still struggling, still facing threats of losing their homes, still not being able to pay their bills in a few months from now, unless Congress takes more action.
Okay, Colin, thank you very much indeed for that. Colin Campbell there joining us from Washington, D.C. Now moving on, more than 1,000 Greek students take to the streets of the capital, Athens, to protest police violence. The rally comes a day after a similar march led to clashes with security forces. During Tuesday's violence, over a dozen people were arrested and 10 officers were hurt, including one with serious head injuries. The rally witnessed 200 hooded protesters throwing rocks and Molotov cocktails at police who responded with tear gas and water cannon. The recent uproar comes after the release of a video that went viral showing an officer beating a man to enforce a coronavirus lockdown. Political commentator Stavros Mavroudis says the recent uproar in Greece is partly driven by the economic downturn in the country.
These events are the result of the accumulated popular anger against the right-wing government and its policies. Its policies can be codified in two things. First, economic policies in favor of big capital, and second, authoritarianism and police repression. Even official statistics published yesterday recognized that there is an approximately 9.6% fall in GDP in 2020. Of course, these are probably Marshall statistics. The real extent of the recession is approximately 12%, which is a huge. Now, the fiscal support provided by the government is very limited.
Elsewhere, according to reports from US media and the government itself, thousands of unaccompanied migrant children are being housed in Customs and Border Protection Office facilities. The number of these children has increased significantly over the past weeks, despite claims by the new administration to tackle the problem. Ronnie Carvello brings us more with this report.
What once caught in the hundreds of children who remained in the border patrol hands when they were cruelly separated from their parents by the Donald Trump regime, now they are counted by the thousands. The number tripled in just a few weeks. According to the internal CBP report, there are more than 3,400 unaccompanied migrant children in cages.
It might be a big problem in the immediate future, like meaning in this couple of months ahead of us, but it's certainly not the main headache as it relates to immigration, because as we know, the problem is much more complex, and it's a problem that he inherited not precisely from the Trump administration, but from years of a broken system that has not been fixed.
What is happening on the United States border was ignored for several days by President Biden's administration, even publicly refusing to accept that they are facing a humanitarian crisis. Still, according to witnesses, this is how they address the issue internally.
It is a humanitarian crisis because every time we deal with groups that migrate and you are not able to accommodate them, the numbers, the volume, it becomes a humanitarian crisis by definition of what a crisis is. However, if we hear carefully, the Biden administration is not labeling a crisis. The word crisis is coming from the conservative, the Republican parties, because the more you label it a crisis, it will give more ammunition from the right to say, you can't solve it.
Aside from being detention cages that is not designed for children, a report indicates that they are sleeping on benches as there are no beds. According to government data, 9,000 migrant children crossed the border in February, but now thousands more are waiting on the Mexican side. Reporting from Miami, Ronnie Carvello.
Brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee, so recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profits on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Reflections on the grand day of Mab'ath. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Hello everyone, and our heartiest congratulations to all on one of the greatest days in the history of mankind. Today is the 27th of the month of Rajab, and it's that glorious day in the pre-dawn hours of which the one and only creator of the entire universe formally entrusted the universal mission for the guidance and salvation of all humanity to his last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. It is the day which all the prophets of the past had foretold. It is the day of the advent of Islam, which means peace, healthy way of life, and submission to none other than God, which was the theme of the messages of prophets of yore around the world since creation, became the formal name of the universal mission of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Before we present you a special program on this auspicious day, here is Ayah 157 of Surah A'raf in the Holy Quran. Those who follow the messenger prophet, the Ummi, that is, not taught by any human, whose mention they find written with them in the Torah and the Evangel, who bids them to do what is right and forbids them from what is wrong, makes lawful to them all the good things and forbids them from all vicious things, and relieves them of their burdens and the shackles that were upon them. Those who believe in him, honor him, and help him and follow the light that has been sent down with him, they are the felicitous. We are celebrating the anniversary of one of the greatest days in the history of mankind. This enlightening event took place on Mount Nur at the Cave of Hira, outside Mecca, on the 27th day of Rajab, when Archangel Gabriel descended with the first rays of divine revelation to the 40-year-old Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Here are Ayahs 1-7 of Surah Alaq, which set in motion the revelation of the entire Quran over the next 23 years, as the final and most comprehensive heavenly scripture for the guidance and salvation of all human beings. Here are Ayahs 1-7 of Surah Alaq in the Holy Quran. Read in the name of your Lord who created man from a clinging mass. Read, and your Lord is the most generous, who taught by the pen, taught man what he did not know. Thus, as is clear, the formal ordainment of the Prophet of Islam occurred in the full limelight of recorded history, unlike the ordainment of the prophets of the past, such as Jesus, Moses, Abraham, Noah, and the countless others whom the one and only Creator had raised in different eras and different parts of the globe, with emphasis on preaching monotheism, virtue, social justice, and all humanitarian values, by desisting from idolatry, atheism, oppression, vices, and indulgence in sins. It was foretold in the Evangel and the Torah, and the previously revealed heavenly scriptures, as well as in the religious texts of the Zoroastrians, the Hindus, and others. Parts of these prophecies are still preserved, in spite of the tampering by interlopers that these books have gone through. For instance, in Deuteronomy, Chapter 18, verse 15, we read the prophecy to Moses. I will raise them up a prophet from among their brethren, Ishmaelite Arabs, like unto thee, and will put my words into his mouth, and he shall speak unto them all that I shall command him. And it shall come to pass that whosoever will not hearken unto my words, which he shall speak in my name. In the Gospel of St. John, chapter 18, verses 7-14, we find the following prophecy of Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him. I have yet many things to say unto you, but ye cannot bear them now. Howbeit, when he, the Spirit of Truth, the Comforter, is come, he will guide into all truth. For he shall not speak of himself, but whatsoever he shall hear, that shall he speak, and he will show you things to come. He shall glorify me, for he shall receive of mine, and shall show it unto you. These prophecies about the Prophet of Islam are not limited to Abrahamic religions, but are also found in the holy books of other religions. For instance, in the Dasatir and Zend Avesta of the Zoroastrians, it is written, "A man will appear from among the Arabs, before whose followers crown, throne, kingdom, and religion shall be overthrown. An arrogant people will be subjugated. Instead of the house of idols and the temple of fire, they will look at the house of worship of Abraham, without any idols in it, and will make it their focal point of worship." It is also interesting to note that in the books of Hindus, such as Kalki Purana and Kalki Avatar, it is mentioned about the Prophet of Islam. His name will be Muhammad. People will be astonished to see his style, and he will not worship as the people of his tribe will be worshipping idols, and he will tell the people that, "I have been told by that Almighty and only one, God, not to indulge in such senseless worship, and I am not turning but to the Lord Most High, therefore you should follow me." Ayah 21 of Surah Ahzab in the Holy Quran, God Almighty says, "In the Prophet of Allah, certainly there is for you an excellent exemplar, for those who look forward to Allah and the last day, and remember Allah greatly." Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, was thus the finest example of a perfect man in every sense of the word. He was a paragon of virtue and a most excellent exemplar for the human race. The Almighty distinguished him from all others by instilling in his sublime personality such fine qualities as modesty, truthfulness, kindness, patience, loyalty, honesty, courage, bravery, generosity, magnanimity, wisdom, and the like. By studying his lofty characteristics and the amazingly simple life that he led, with his household, companions, wives, and others, we are able to learn valuable lessons from his conduct and accordingly mold our own lifestyle. Our society could never be an Islamic one unless we sincerely tread the footsteps of Allah's final messenger to mankind, heed his sayings, and emulate his practice and behavior, his sunnah and seerah, as the faithful among his companions did. This means to desist from whatever he has forbidden and obey whatever he has bequeathed to us. The most important point to note is that the event of Mab'ath took place in the presence of a witness, who has related it precisely in the most perfect manner in one of his flawlessly eloquent sermons, which also inform us of the loud moan of Satan, who became dismayed forever about the success of his deceit. The witness was none other than the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, who was, as a 10-year-old boy, used to take food and clothing to his 40-year-old cousin on Mount Nur during the days of solitude the latter would spend at the cave of Hira. The person whom the Prophet, by the express commandment of God, formally proclaimed as vicegerent on the plain of Qadir Khum on 18th of Zilhajjah in the year 10 AH, 23 years after the Mab'ath, says in Sermon 191 of his famous book Nahjul Balagha, "When I was only a child, he took charge of me. I used to follow him like a young camel following in the footprints of his mother. Every day he would show me some of his high traits and commanded me to follow it. Every year he used to go into seclusion to the Mount of Hira, where I saw him, but no one else used to see him. I used to see and watch the effulgence of divine revelation and message, and breathe the scent of prophethood. When the revelation descended on the Prophet of Allah, I heard the moan of Satan. I asked, 'O Prophet of Allah, what is this moan?' He replied, 'This is Satan, who has lost all hope of being worshipped. O Ali, you see all that I see, and you hear all that I hear, except that you are not a prophet, but you are a vicegerent.'" Now we better understand that adherence to the path of the seal of messengers is not complete unless the believers follow the footsteps of his divinely designated heir, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, and the 11 other infallible imams of his progeny, the last of whom is in occultation by the will of God, and will reappear in the end times as Mahdi al-Qa'im to establish the global government of peace, prosperity and justice, by ridding the planet of all vestiges of corruption and oppression. That is the reason we have been advised to perform the special ziyarah of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, in Najaf on the grand day of Mab'ath, and, if travel is not possible, to recite it by turning towards the direction of Najaf from wherever we happen to be.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. What would have happened if Hezbollah had been vanquished? That's perhaps the most significant and upsetting question about the 2006 war.
Much has been said about the 2006 war, about its motives, the behind the scenes, and the circumstances around it, its planning and development, its details and objectives, as well as its outcome and the lessons learned from the war. Also, much speculation has been made about what led to the war. When considering the situation in Lebanon, in the occupying Zionist regime, in Palestine, and in the region, as well as the U.S. role in the war. One of the main issues that needs a close look is what would have happened if the resistance in Lebanon was defeated.
How did Hezbollah defeat Israel?
Part 3.
Speaking of a hypothetical defeat would not be possible without examining the history of Arab defeats. Just as one cannot hypothesize about Hezbollah's defeat without taking into account the nature and identity of the supposed winner. There are two other questions that have to be asked. One is, how did Israel overcome the Arabs? And the other is, how did Hezbollah defeat Israel? Only then can one hypothesize about the consequences of a Hezbollah defeat in the 2006 war. The World Cup opening match was held between Argentina and Belgium. On that day, the Lebanese capital Beirut was under attack by Israeli fighter jets and tanks that had the city under siege. Beirut's siege happened during the World Cup, where two Arab nations, Kuwait and Algeria, were present. Algeria beat Germany, and Kuwait Football Federation chief Fahad al-Ahmad al-Sabah halted the Kuwait-France match to protest France's fourth goal. He fought for 7 minutes, and the referee was forced to annul the goals.
As Israelis stepped up their bombing campaign, battle intensified. We thought Beirut burning under fire would shock the world, that the world will react to landing of a mortar, al-Burj al-Baraj building in the city, and the deaths of at least 75 innocent humans. We witnessed rallies in Algeria, but we later realized that they were just cheering for Algeria's victory against Germany in the World Cup.
Demonstrations were held across the Arab world because they thought Algeria's elimination from the World Cup had been a fix. But no one took to the street for the occupation of the second Arab capital after Al-Quds. Before the establishment of Hezbollah, Lebanon had seen several conflicts with Israel. There were two kinds of wars. Firstly, the partisan and army battles where national and Palestinian resistance groups were involved. And secondly, the battle fought by the Syrian army in the 1982 Lebanon-Israel conflict. In 1982, Israeli forces were double the combined number of troops Syria and Egypt had deployed in the October 1973 war. But Israel faced two different forms of resistance, military and non-military, in Lebanon. But how did Israel achieve victory against them? The natural elements of the Lebanese battlefield and its complex geography, with its heights and narrow passes through the mountains, left Israel no option but to employ new tactics. The strategy relied on heavy use of infantry and greater use of units than Israel dispatched for the 1973 war, but across a smaller area of only 70 kilometers. Israel used the maximum number of troops possible to take control of main crossways and sensitive points, overlooking key towns and cities, while taking hold of key geographical locations. To be able to reorganize its forces, Israel wanted a second portion of its troops to quickly advance towards Beirut, while the first groups had resistance forces encircled. The second group was to be supported by special forces, who would provide them with their needed equipment deep in Lebanese territory through marine or air transport methods. However, the Israeli army faced a demographic factor, a major geostrategic element in the war. They didn't have the needed experience to fight in urban and residential areas. Classic armies naturally avoid entering populated areas to prevent troop casualties, since such areas are full of buildings that limit movement. The Israeli forces were built upon heavy armored units supported by infantry, but Tel Aviv had not improved its infantry tactics, despite the fact that its troops had to fight face-to-face battles against popular resistance forces to be able to encircle them. The low number of Israeli infantry units gave the Lebanese and Palestinian resistance groups the opportunity of free movement and of engaging Israeli forces, though they failed to use the existing opportunity. The Lebanese National Resistance Front and the Palestinian Resistance Forces retreated as the classic Israeli army advanced into Lebanon that was done in accordance with non-military principles without undermining their policy of confrontation. This is what Chinese leader and one of the most significant guerrilla war theorists, Mao Zedong, used to say. He said, "Escape when an army attacks you, confront it when it settles down, and follow it when it retreats."
Yasser Arafat used his entire experience of guerrilla wars. He had access to the experience of a full range of resistance movements, including those from Russia and Algeria, as well as weapons from across the globe. The Japanese also helped him along with their Red Army, German guerrilla group Badr-Menov Group, and Italy's Red Brigades. All of them sympathized with the Palestinian issue, as they had Arab countries' facilities at their disposal and even had interests in the Arab oil industry. The Palestinian resistance staged a hard-fought partisan battle since the very establishment of the Zionist regime. The battle had a history of ups and downs, both in Palestine and outside, including in Jordan and Lebanon. Therefore, it was not a domestic guerrilla war, and there is no partisan battle except that it gains victory. This is a historically recognized fact based on the experience of the wars of the past.
On October 6th, the Israeli army, equipped with large numbers of Merkava tanks, launched a pitched battle against Lebanon. Israeli forces began advancing along several axes with a focus on the coastal areas. One of the most important classic battles of the 1982 war took place here in this place, where Israeli and Syrian armies engaged in the Battle of Sultan Yaqub. During the battle, Syrian army forces inflicted heavy damage on Israeli armored personnel carriers that stopped them from advancing. In just 5 days, the Israelis managed to extend their domination to two-thirds of Lebanon. That was when they realized the road to Beirut was all clear. They were finally within kilometers of the Lebanese capital on June 9th. On that day, Lebanon witnessed one of the heaviest air battles in modern times.
كان البقاع ولا يزال جزءا من النطاق الأمني السوري إلى دمشق وسوريا.
Beqa has always been part of Syria's security margin for Damascus. Therefore, Syria has to keep its security presence at the border town to make up for Lebanon's weak border security in the valley. If not, Israelis could use the Beqa area to enter Lebanon, while military forces in Bilad al-Sham
Greater Syria, which is 30 kilometers away from Baqa, could not defend the area. Therefore, Syria had to set up its defenses from outside of Bilad al-Sham and deployed its SAM-6 anti-air defense system to Lebanon to that end. The key issue here is that back in 1982, the Israeli enemies wanted both to get rid of the Palestinian Liberation Organization and prevent Arabs, especially Syrians, from repeating the victories they gained during the 1973 war. Arabs could reduce Israel's air superiority through creation of a semi-active air defense system, providing more ease of movement to Syrian and Egyptian forces. The advantage cost Israelis part of their air force and surprised them for a short period of time, providing the Arab side of the war with a sort of a victory. In fact, all of that was an achievement of the air defense systems of Egypt and Syria, especially the latter's, as Syrian soldiers used the air defense system with ultimate skill.
In June 1982, the Israelis resorted to destroying missile systems in an attempt to prevent limited successes of the Arabs in the October War. After the destruction of the air defense systems, Syrians deployed 100 aircraft to counter the Israelis' air assaults. The Israelis responded with ambushing the Syrian fighter jets. One of such tactics was the use of F-16 aircraft able to tackle air-to-air missiles of Syria's MiG-23 fighter jets, leading to the destruction of a large number of Syrian jets, up to 36 of them.
In 1982, the Syrian army faced a large-scale attack that led to many deaths. They forced Syria out of southern Beirut and the Jabal area and besieged Syrian forces in Baqa. They pushed the large Syrian contingent out of southern Beirut. The 85th Brigade left Beirut with its flag lowered due to a planned peace agreement. On the fifth day of the war, Israel ended the battle with Syria, setting the stage for talks.
This was the climax of the Israeli military doctrine's achievements. The doctrine proved to itself and to the world that it is effective and successful both against popular resistance movements and military tactics of classic armies, as it overcame both classic and non-classic methods of battle on Lebanese soil.
Palestinian resistance groups also did their best, including by volunteer operations, aircraft hijacking, and domestic operations, but they led nowhere.
Only then did a man emerge before the eyes of the world who said Israel had been trapped. And at his hands and under his supervision, we were told of the auspicious birth of a unique form of fighting, comprised of the three elements of faith, jihad, and martyrdom, so that it sets out a new direction, which Ruhollah dubbed Hezbollah. The party of Allah, they will be predominant. And only a few years later, Yitzhak Shamir told the world that Hezbollah are only a different sort of Arabs.
The creation of the Islamic resistance in Lebanon shook the pillars of Israel's security doctrine. The Islamic resistance adopted a special method in the battle against the Israeli forces, which were defeated neither by classic armies nor in non-military battles. Hezbollah put up an unprecedented fight in the history of military science and overcame Israelis. The victory had nothing to do with the geographic elements, as the Palestinian resistance battled Israelis in the same environment. It was not also because Hezbollah was a Lebanese movement, as even the Lebanese and their popular movements fought Israel with the same weapons and on the same lands, but failed to defeat Israel. It was not the territory that gave Hezbollah the upper hand. As Palestinians engaged Israelis in the same territory, so did the Lebanese. Then what made the difference?
Tactic is the element that puts different forms of knowledge at the service of a battle. The more skillful and capable a commander, the fresher and more creative his military tactics would be. It means a capable commander's exceptional leadership and war plans are the results of defining the principles and rules of battle in a specific way. These two factors are in turn rooted in the commander's perception of the principles of war and his detailed assessment of the facts on the ground in the battlefield. The rules of battle can be both firm and flexible. Did Hezbollah develop a special tactic during its years of resistance? Is Hezbollah now in possession of a new technology they have adapted to the battlefield?
In theory, tactic is the knowledge of capabilities, technologies, and details. But in practice, tactic is the ability to create a link between creativity, flexibility, and moderate decision-making in the difficult conditions of the battlefield against a shrewd enemy, coupled with the commander's understanding of the human nature and the impact of the war on his soldiers. Therefore, when we say resistance shattered the enemy on the battlefield, it means the enemy was defeated on the three tactical, practical, and strategic levels. That was what led to the shattering of the enemy's national security doctrine.
Over the years, Hezbollah has been fighting Israel. The resistance developed a military concept of its own. Therefore, what it laid out in southern Lebanon was different from its entire experience of the past.
ما شهدناه في العام 2000 تحديدا من أداء لجنود ونخب العدو.
What we saw in the year 2000 was that enemy soldiers, its special forces and officers, as well as their whole military establishment, were present in Lebanon. However, none of them could give the slightest response to the operation by the resistance, which demonstrates any operation planned by the movement leads to victory, and nothing can be done to counter or stop it. This was the conclusion that led the enemy to retreat.
Israel was twice taken by surprise by Hezbollah. First, by Hezbollah's preparedness for war, and second, by its realization that what it accomplished in the past and the powerful means it used to make those accomplishments were no longer effective against such a well-prepared opponent. The July battle was different from all the past battles Israel had fought since its establishment. Military history proved the superiority of Hezbollah over Israel's military doctrine, which had earlier proved itself effective against the Arabs' both classic and non-classic warfare. Israel faced a new form of resistance, which was fledging back in 1982 and hit its climax in July 2006.
Some say the enemy was on the defensive before the year 2000. However, if we assume that invasion is the key decisive advantages in a war, it was Israel that had the advantage in 2006, as it was Israel that made the assault. We witnessed terrible scenes during the war. The enemy's performance was extremely poor. Researchers said the poor performance was rooted in Israel's failure to balance